Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today is a familiar voice to NPR listeners. Don Gagne is a national political correspondent for NPR and spends much of his time traveling throughout the United States covering campaigns, elections, and the political climate throughout the country. He started as NPR's White House correspondent in 2001, at the same time that George W. Bush moved into the White House, and continued covering the White House and President Obama until spring of 2012, when Don Gagne moved into his current position. He has filed reports from around the world, including Moscow, Beijing, London, San Salvador, and Hanoi. Over the years, he's contributed to PBS's NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, the BBC, and CBC, has won numerous national and state awards for his reporting, and periodically teaches college journalism courses. He's an honors graduate of Michigan State University. Don Gagne, welcome.
Hi, thanks for the shout-out to my alma mater. And we'll see how the Detroit Tigers finish this year, and we'll be really happy. So, hi. Glad to be here.
Well, speaking of colleges, Chico is a college town, as you know. So I wanted to ask you about your role as a college teacher. What appeals to you about teaching college students?
It is something that I've always loved to do. And it's also, in another world, it's the profession that I suspect I would have chosen and found my way into if I hadn't become a journalist. And there's something about a classroom of, in the case of what I teach, of journalism students or a political science class or whatever it happens to be, of eager, curious, interested, smart students that I find engages me and gets me to think about maybe stories and how I approach my work, in different ways. But it's also such a great thing to be able to share, what I've learned and what I've done and what I've stumbled upon and what I've screwed up over the years with students who are interested in the profession. So that's really the fun. It's it's a little bit like radio, but there's been an editor looking over your shoulder, and you're still sharing information and telling stories and hopefully helping someone start down the path to what has been really a fun and rewarding career that I've had.
I'll bet one of the questions they want to ask you is, how does a journalist manage to get a plum position like you have?
Do you really want to hear how I got here? Because I do tell students this a lot, especially if I'm doing a career day. So I got out of school in 1979, 1980. It's a little bit kind of squishy. My senior year kind of became a second degree and a fifth year. But I did not study journalism. I studied broadcasting at Michigan State, and I have a degree in advertising as well. And what I knew back then was that I wanted to write, that I wanted to do something creative. I had always been a news junkie from the time I was a little kid. That was something I got from my mother, watching Walter Cronkite every night and watching John Chancellor and Huntley and Brinkley and watching the political conventions. I remember watching the 1968 convention on three black and white TVs at once in my household and turning up the volume on one that looked most interesting at the time. So I was doing that stuff as a kid, but for whatever reason, I never thought of journalism as a profession. So anyway, I get out of school, and I did, like many students, had a hard time finding a job, and did after several months land one at my local hometown commercial radio station. My hometown is Monroe, Michigan. And they hired me to be a country western disc jockey.
Oh, my.
And I'll tell you, I love Johnny Cash. I love Hank Williams Sr. I love George Jones. I love that great old, real deal country music. But I'd never imagined I would be a disc jockey. But you know, you go to the interview and they're going to pay you basically minimum wage. So anything they say to you, you just say, yes, I can do that. Next thing you know, you've got the job. And I'll tell you, I was the worst country western disc jockey in the history of country western disc jockeys. But it was a foot in the door. And what I found out was that I kind of liked radio. And this medium that I never really thought of as a profession really did kind of seem to suit me. But then here's the other thing. This is back, 1981 at this point. I did that job for a year, and there was a guy in the newsroom who was covering all the local, city council and county commissioner stories and the annual flooding, and they were building a nuclear plant in town. And he was doing newscasts like every hour on the hour in the middle of my show and the other shows. And he just looked like he was having a lot more fun than me. So he got another job after a year, and I became the news director at this small commercial station in my hometown. And immediately, everything just seemed to click. It was like, oh, why didn't I think of this? This is what I was supposed to be doing. Now, again, it was commercial radio. I was also, by then, a huge fan of NPR, which is still in its relatively, early days. It wasn't even a decade old yet. And what I used to do is, because I didn't have any formal journalism training, I used to tape All Things Considered every night. Literally, I would pop in a 90-minute cassette every night and tape it. It was then a 90-minute show. And I would drive around. Instead of listening to music, I'd listen to those tapes of Colkey Roberts reporting from Capitol Hill or Linda Wertheimer reporting on politics and those great arts pieces Susan Sandberg was doing and is still doing, but was doing back then. And I would try to mimic what they were doing on my little hometown radio station. And lo and behold, to make a long story short, within about 4 years, I was working for the Detroit Public Radio Station. But in those years, I was really kind of unwittingly preparing myself for the job I have today by studying the work of my now colleagues so closely and doing my best to mimic it. I was sorry if this answer is getting too long, but I worked as NPR's Detroit bureau for about 14 years. But when you work in a bureau, and if you're the kind of person who can hit a deadline and cover breaking news and file a story from a rolling bus, that sort of thing helps. What you do is every election cycle, you get pulled in. Some might say you get sucked into election coverage. So I would start covering political stories in Michigan, and then when presidential candidates came to Michigan and Ohio, I'd cover them. And suddenly in 1996, I would find myself, spending some time on the bus, and same in 2000. And during the 2000 election, somebody at NPR decided they liked the coverage I was doing, again, kind of bouncing in and out of the presidential campaign. And they asked me if I'd move to Washington to cover the White House. And it was both a hard decision and an easy decision. It was easy because you're going to do it. It was a hard decision because I was going to leave a great college town. I lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan at the time. But we packed up the kids and moved to Washington. And as my wife and I like to joke, we're now 12 years into the 2-year commitment we made. And the kids love living there, and I'm sure covered some great and fascinating stories in the 12 years, and some horrible stories and some uplifting ones. It's really kind of covered the spectrum, I think.
Let me remind listeners that my guest is Don Gagne, who is NPR political correspondent. And you, in fact, are right now, I mentioned that you travel a lot, right now in the Baltimore airport, aren't you?
Yes, if you can hear the noise in the background. I found kind of a secluded place here in the airport, but I still get the announcements up above on the speakers. And as we speak, I've just returned home. I literally landed 10 minutes ago, and I'll have a weekend at home before heading out again to chase the next story.
Speaking of technology, I would guess that over the course of your career, there have been changes in technology in the way you file your reports.
Oh, absolutely. And I do joke that the budget was so small at that first radio station I worked at, we had manual typewriters in the newsroom. We had a manual typewriter.
I remember
those. In the
newsroom,
I should say. Now, there were still IBM Selectrics and all the modern things of the day out and about. but this was a station that still had kind of a primitive setup. But I started on a manual typewriter. I started my journalism career. But I used to carry around a Marantz cassette recorder that was the size of the thickest encyclopedia on your shelf. I've had that even dates us, doesn't it, using the word encyclopedia on the shelf. But it was this huge machine, and it had a strap, and you know, it was about 3.5 or 4 inches thick and 12 or 15 inches long and probably 9 inches deep. And you'd put your cassette on that, and off you'd go to interview people. And I think it took something like 6 or 8 D-sized batteries. And these days, I have, it's still a Marantz. So I guess we get a hand to Marantz for still, you know, producing the equipment we're using. But it's a Marantz digital recorder that's literally the size of a pack of cigarettes. And I put an SD chip in the bottom of it, and I plug a really nice, you know, Audio Technica shotgun mic into it, which is a mic that I've actually been carrying around and using for about 12, 13 years now. It's really old faithful. But on one SD chip, depending on how big of a chip I use, I can record 4 or 8 or 12 hours of audio on that one tiny little chip. So all of the lugging extra cassettes around and lugging boxes of batteries, all of that is a thing of the past. And then the other just truly amazing thing is with 4G cards that we plug into our computer or with Wi-Fi or whatever else, I can literally get a story on the air in high broadcast digital quality from any place where I can get a signal. And sometimes we carry satellite phones around. So you don't even have to be someplace where you can get a signal. This is, as long as you've got a clear view of a satellite, you know, up in the sky that you can point this sat phone at, you can get on the air and sound like you are in the studio next door or sitting right next to the host. It's amazing.
Well, now, speaking of live reporting, there was a time shortly after you arrived at the White House, being the White House correspondent, that something happened that I just imagine how could you... I thought it must have been challenging to report on something when you didn't have the whole picture. I'm talking about September the 11th, 2001. You were at the White House that morning. And what did you think was happening?
On that day, President Bush was down in Florida. And I was NPR's only White House correspondent then. The network has since beefed up the White House beat. There are now 3 people on the beat. But for my first 4 years on the beat, and George W. Bush's first 4 years as president, I was NPR's only White House correspondent. He was in Florida that day. I mean, everybody's seen that footage of him reading to school kids. And it was one of those deals where he was going to give an education speech. It was a speech he'd given many times. There was not going to be anything new in the speech. So, you know, we decided to save some money and some wear and tear and everything else and just watch him from afar. Well, I had taken the opportunity to drop my 2 daughters off at school that morning, just a few blocks from our house. And after I dropped them off, I was walking to the bus stop and was kind of taking my time getting down to the White House, knowing it was going to be empty that day without the president there. And my editor, Ron Elving, calls me on my cell phone, and he says, did you hear a plane crash into the World Trade Center, some kind of freak accident or something? But, you know, the White House might have something to say about it, so just be prepared to kind of, you know, look into that once you get there. So that was the first I'd heard, and I thought what everybody thought at that point, that it was, you know, an accident, like the time the plane crashed into the Empire State Building. Minutes later, he called me back and he says a second plane is hit. At that point, obviously, we all know what it is. So instead of waiting for the bus, you know, I run the few blocks to Connecticut Avenue, jump in a cab, and head to the White House to get there more quickly. And I do recall thinking that I was going to a place that could potentially be a target if something was up. I mean, you kind of think that in the abstract, but you don't dwell on it, and you don't particularly worry about it because it does seem like, you know, a long shot still. But by the time I got to the White House, you know, they were really in kind of full lockdown mode. But I had my badges, the badge that gets reporters into the White House every day, and I was in the process of going through the security gate. And just as I was halfway through that process, the thing that you do every day when you go in, somebody on the other side of the fence, I heard them shout that the Pentagon had been hit. And at that point, the White House was evacuated. I never got past that front gate. And I stood there as I watched people just kind of pour out of the White House and kind of get a, you know, surround me and head across Pennsylvania Avenue into Lafayette Park. And, you know, I remember seeing young women who work in the White House running up the driveway, carrying their high heels so they could run faster. And I remember the very surreal sight of dozens, it might have even been 100 people dressed in white smocks with tall white kind of cardboard chef's hats on, suddenly all over the place. And I'm thinking, you know, is this like some kind of weird dream I'm having? But there was supposed to be that very night a big congressional barbecue hosted by the president on the south lawn of the White House. And these were all the chefs and food prep workers who were getting ready for that huge party with hundreds of members of Congress that night. They were all evacuated. Everybody was evacuated. Well, you know, of course, you start to see the fighter jets flying overhead immediately. And that was actually an oddly reassuring thing, even though they were flying pretty low, you know, over the White House and in that corridor between the White House and the Capitol and the like. It was and remains one of the most vivid days. I mean, it's just burned into my memory, every detail of it. And it was 11 years ago now, I guess, almost exactly. But it still feels like it was yesterday. Obviously, it set the country on a course that we, you know, we feel every day, from the war in Afghanistan that's still underway, to the Iraq war, to what it's like when we go to airports, to, you know, I mean, and on and on and on and on. It is so many facets of our life. But I spent the day basically in Lafayette Park, and then they pushed the perimeter out to E Street, trying to maintain a cell signal with NPR and just doing live reports with Morning Edition and then all the way through to All Things Considered with kind of what the scene was outside the White House. We were getting very little information. White House officials who were still in town had little to share with us. And probably one of the very kind of strange little sidebars of that day was, because I was on the street and on a cell phone, I was nowhere near a television set. So it wasn't until I was walking back to NPR at the end of the day, I stopped into the lobby of the National Press Building, and I saw the TV screens that they have in their lobby there with all the news networks on. It was the first time I'd actually seen the images. So in some ways, I experienced it, you know, the way NPR listeners experienced it, by just kind of hearing it described on the radio and, of course, describing my one piece of the story myself for the NPR audience. But it was a day when you're a reporter, yes, but you're also, you know, you're also a human being and very much kind of caught up in what it is and worried about how are your kids are going to get out of school and, you know, are they going to get home? And I remember having a brief conversation with my wife, telling her, if you feel the need to get out of town and evacuate, you may not be able to reach me to tell me, so just go if you think that's important. And that's not the kind of conversation you expect to have, you know, with your spouse on a beautiful, sunny fall day when you just dropped your kids off at school and everything seemed normal.
My guest is Don Gagne, who is NPR national political correspondent, and he was at the White House on the morning of September the 11th, 2001. And I was imagining how it must be difficult to report on when you don't have the whole picture. You don't see the pictures that most of America had seen.
And my lifeline was what I was hearing in my, you know, in my headphones or through the back through the earpiece of my cell phone, because I was getting the NPR feed. So I was listening to all of our rolling coverage, even as I was contributing what I was seeing. And you know, you're just part of kind of one huge effort. And in our case, it was obviously reporters in New York and reporters in Pennsylvania and reporters in Washington and reporters at the Pentagon and ultimately reporters around the world, all kind of filing their piece of the story. And you know, I mean, I think NPR can be very, very proud of what we did in those first, those crazy, hectic, you know, days when the attack happened, But then in continuing to cover it for the weeks and the months and for a long, long time afterward.
Well, I would imagine that of the stories you've covered, that one stands out probably as the most memorable. But do you have other stories that stand out for you?
There are a lot. And, you know, some of them are simple things. Like when I was in Detroit covering the auto industry, when the first kind of big contractions at General Motors were happening. And this would have been in the, you know, early 1990s. And I remember going to a bar across the street from the legendary old Fleetwood Cadillac plant in Detroit where the last car had just rolled off the line. And all of these people who'd worked there forever, and it was their livelihood, and they had no idea how bad things were truly going to get for the automobile industry, you know, especially what we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years. But to be talking to those workers about this moment, you know, in their life, this time of uncertainty and this tragedy of this plant closing. And I'm talking about, I remember one guy telling me that, you know, he'd come in there every day and there was always a car coming down the line and always a bolt to be put on and always, you know, whatever your job of the day was to do. And the cars kept coming like infinity. And all of a sudden, infinity stopped. The last car went past. And, you know, he talked about how he dealt with that. So you get a lot of stories like that. But then you get stories like the 2000 election. And I found myself in West Palm Beach, Florida, you know, looking in the windows where those election workers and volunteers were holding up the ballots to light to try to decide if the Chad that was hanging there was really an Al Gore vote or if it were actually George Bush vote or whatever it was. And you find yourself kind of in these moments, and sometimes they are these huge stories that you know you'll be talking about forever. And sometimes they're just these little moments where you've encountered somebody who said something to you that's just so personal, and you feel so lucky that, you know, they felt comfortable enough to share it with you because it illuminates some other story that you've been covering. Or maybe it doesn't illuminate anything. Maybe it's just a moment. So certainly 9/11 is the most memorable story, but there's so many different kinds of stories you get to cover, and it's probably more than anything the thing that that keeps me fresh and keeps me excited about this work. And when I do talk to, you know, college kids, I tell them that, you know, I've been at this for a long time, and there's never been a day when my alarm has gone off in the morning and I've thought, oh, I don't want to go to work, you know? I mean, there have been days when my alarm has gone off and I've said, gee, I don't want to get up. But work has never been the problem. It's always been a very great, you know, privilege and fun thing to do, to be able to wake up and do this work and of course, to do it for NPR, too.
Thank you so much for talking to us, Don Gagne. We're going to take a short break, but coming up, I'll be talking to Corning author Charles Rouse about his book, The Life and Times of Braden Schultz and Other Works. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My next guest is Corning author Charles Rouse. Charles Rouse was raised in Glendora, California. He is an Air Force veteran and graduate of Occidental College. He's a former banker, retired olive farmer, retired postal worker, an Episcopal priest, retired from parish duties. In 2012, Charles Rouse ran for office in California's 3rd Assembly District. He has now published a second book, The Life and Times of Braden Schultz and Other Works. He has a BA in philosophy and writes about philosophy in the third part of this new book. Charles Rouse, welcome.
Why, thank you very much, Nancy. Glad to be here. It's an honor and a privilege. And incidentally, all the writers locally are glad that you support local authors.
Oh, well, I appreciate that.
Well,
we do
appreciate you.
Thank you, Charles. Well, I pick up your book and I look at the cover and I wonder, did you design it? Because I look to see who designed the cover. Did you design it?
I did not. That was my publisher is Writers Cosmos, and I thought they did a real good job on the cover.
Yeah, because the title, The Life and Times of Braden Schultz.
Yes.
And we don't see the face. There's a photo. Well, you describe what's on your cover.
Well, it shows a young man, a boy. In the story, he's 18 years old, and he's sitting on a bench facing away with a clarinet next to him. He is somewhat redheaded. And he's wearing the typical teenage outfit of a T-shirt and, I think, Levi's.
Yeah, because when I look at this, it's gray. And when I first looked, I didn't see the clarinet even, but I saw his red hair because that's about the only color. Other things are kind of black and white.
Yeah, right.
So we figured, well, this must be the young man in the title of your book. But I'd like to skip to the very back part of your book.
That's okay. Yeah, good.
Your book is written in three parts, so I was curious about the title of the second part is, the third part, that is, Greek Subjectivism.
Yes.
Immanuel Kant and Willard Van Orman Quine.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the beginning of this section, number one, the question, and you have a quote, and when you first read that quote, you wonder, well, how does that relate to anything?
Did you want me to read it?
Why don't you read that?
Man is the measure of all things, of the things that are, that they are, and the things that are not, that they are not. That was a quote from Protagoras, the Greek philosopher. It's usually simplified to man is the measure of all things.
Yeah, so this philosopher, people may not have heard of Protagoras. And it starts, man is the measure of all things. What?
Yeah, right.
I'm sure you came across this in your studies many years ago when you were majoring in philosophy.
Sure, yeah.
And then you go on to say, yeah, you mean measure. When you say measurements.
Yes, I do.
So then you take a look at measurements. So where did we get this idea of an inch?
You know, the English inch was standardized as the width of a mature man's thumb pressed on a flat surface. That's a kind of an approximation. And most of our measurements were approximations at one time, which have since become quite standard.
And then we can kind of guess. We call it 12 inches. We call it a foot.
That's correct.
So.
And we know why it's called a foot, because it's the length of a mature man's, like about a six-foot guy, the length of his foot. Of course, it's approximate. Like I say, these measurements were originally approximate and have since become standardized.
Well, and you say that even goes back to ancient Greece and ancient Rome, that a foot was understood to be that average length of a mature man.
Yes.
So, wow. So in this Greek philosopher, Protagoras says, man is the measure of all things. This is a literal, he means it literally.
Well, I'm not sure how he meant it because we don't have his original work. We have quotations from it. And this is one of the quotations. I think he meant it more in a general sense than specific. But of course, there were specifics.
Well, one thing that is puzzling is, because we understand foot, inches, but when people read the Bible, they come across a cubit.
Yeah.
And what in the world was a cubit?
A cubit was originally the length of a forearm, of a mature man.
So if you measure from the elbow to the tip of your finger.
Yes.
Then there's another measurement, and I'm not a sailor, so I don't typically have to deal with fathoms unless I'm reading.
Right.
And what the heck is a fathom?
they would actually take the rope and stretch it out and go like this. Now, a 6 foot.
Yeah, now, since listeners can't see, you've extended your arms out.
Both arms.
Both arms.
Yeah.
Straight out from the shoulders.
Yeah, holding a rope. See, 1 fathom, 2 fathoms, 3 fathoms. Now, a 6 foot man will have about a 6 foot arm span from if he holds his arms out side to side. So that's what a fathom is. They would just count the fathoms as they're pulling the rope up.
And that was very convenient. You've got the rope. You just stretch out your arms from fingertip to fingertip.
Yeah.
And then what about a yard? Now, a yard, I think I know what a yard is, but what about the human body's relationship to a yard?
The yard is using the same thing, but with one arm.
So, and you have your thumb about at your sternum, the middle of
right.
your chest,
yeah.
and extending one arm, and that
yeah.
was a yard.
So the yard comes to about 3 feet.
So a fathom and a yard are the fathom 6 feet and the yard 3 feet.
Right.
Okay. Now, here's something that I find interesting is we use the word here in the United States. We measure the distance from here to Corning, your town, in miles.
Correct.
And where did we get the word mile?
We get the word miles from Latin, mille paces, 1,000 paces.
So you take 1,000 paces, and that's a mile.
Well, for the Romans, it was. I don't know how.
For the Romans, yeah.
I don't know how that translates to the standard American mile. I actually don't.
And you've mentioned that we eventually standardize these measurements.
Right.
So
sure.
if I'm a seamstress, I know how many inches. They're all yeah. going to be the same. But we go to Europe, and they're not using this system.
No, they don't indeed.
So where in the world did all these, the metric system come from?
I think it came from France, and it came from the science of French scientists, and they wanted to standardize measurement, and they did, and most of Europe did that, and the United States was going to, then we didn't. Canada was going to, and then they didn't. They did
yeah.
it kind of halfway.
Because it's hard to change.
It is, yeah. And the United States never changed away from feet and inches. We never went to metric, but everyone else does. My wife is Mexican, and she grew up using metric and had, and you know, had to transfer over to English measurements. And now she's kind of vague on what the metrics are.
Well, you mentioned that you think it was the French that did this, and it would make sense then if you're going to have a measurement of long distance that maybe it would go through Paris. And I was intrigued by the fact that you say a meter
right.
was originally defined to be 1/10,000,000th of the distance between the North Pole and the equator
yeah.
going through Paris.
Yeah.
I never knew that.
Well.
that's a meter. 1/10,000,000th of that distance,
yeah.
North Pole to equator.
Exactly how you measure that, I have no idea.
But I wondered too.
That's what they say, yeah.
Okay, so you say using the meter, is the metric system, man, the measure of all things? I think so. That's what you say. You say humans make the measurement and establish the standards. And though the meter was based on the Earth is, after all, our home planet.
Yes, it is indeed.
Now, you have a section on the Critique of Pure Reason that you're quoting Immanuel Kant. And what did you think was interesting about Kant?
What was interesting about Kant for me as a philosophy major was I struggled to understand it. And eventually I came to a kind of an understanding, at least in my own mind, of what Kant was talking about. And I thought, well, I'll go on to refute him because, after all, he's an antique philosopher from way back when.
Yeah, that was
so
a long time ago.
We're living in modern times. I was never able to get around Kant. I still can't. So basically, by default, I am Kantian. Neo-Kantian, of course, but Kantian.
Well, so that's one of the philosophers. And you say, perhaps in this next section, perhaps the central and most controversial thesis of the Critique of Pure Reason is that human beings experience only appearances, not things in themselves.
Yeah.
And that space and time are only subjective forms of human intuition, that, and you go on. That's a mouthful.
Indeed it is. It's a mouthful. It's a headful, too.
Yes, a headful. That human beings experience only appearances.
Yes. Well, our reality is our reality. Kant was not a subjectivist. This is real. I'm knocking on the table. This is real. There's no question about that. Mathematics works. Physics works. There's no question about that either. But we don't understand the essence of things because we understand them through the perception that humans have, the human perceptive mold, the four-dimensional space-time and plus causation. Of course, I go on in there. I don't know if you're going to get to it.
In your book, yeah.
But I go on to color. Color is essentially subjective.
Yes.
Did you ever think of that?
I have thought that. I hadn't put it that way exactly, I don't think, but I have that. I agree with you there.
Yeah, yeah. You can measure color by using a light meter or something, but that's not how we describe it. We don't describe it in terms of waves and all that. We describe color in terms of red, blue, yellow.
Yes.
And that's a human experience. I might point out that birds don't have that same same color scheme.
That was so fascinating. It's toward the end of your third section in your book. You talk about other philosophers, but you have section 6, the vision of birds.
Yes. They have established, incidentally, this is not an old-timey thing. This is like the 1970s. But they established that birds can see ultraviolet. We didn't know that before, but they can, and we don't. So birds can see better than we do in some sense. They can see more of light than we do. And they have, of course, a mix of colors, but they can include the ultraviolet. So it must be quite remarkable to be a bird. It would be anyway, but yeah.
Well, I think people have observed the fact that dogs, and we actually use dogs' sense of smell for a lot of reasons.
Oh, yeah.
So we know that, okay, dogs have a greater sense of smell than we do, but I don't think people know that birds...
They can see more than we can see.
Than we can see. Well, we have the expression eagle eyes.
Yeah, for sure.
We do know that they have sharp vision.
Amazing.
But color?
Vision. Yeah. Color also, yeah. They have colors that we don't have. Now, what that would look like, I have no idea. You know, you don't know. That's the whole, I think that's, in a sense, that's the whole point. You don't know what the birds see because you're not a bird, right?
Well, and also we don't know their language. I think birds have language, but we just maybe don't understand the language.
Oh, I hear it every morning.
Oh, I do too.
And I don't understand it. I like it.
I can only identify a few bird sounds. But you say that birds presumably have an enormously enriched color palette compared to the simple and clunky human perception of color. So our perception is clunky, Charles.
It is by comparison, we assume, yeah.
We're going to take a short break, and then I'll be back to continue my conversation with Corning author Charles Rouse. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm back with my guest, Corning author Charles Rouse, whose new book is The Life and Times of Braden Schultz and Other Works. So right now I'm asking about the other works in this book.
Okay.
Like the fact that birds have this vision of colors that we don't have. And you say that it's color is subjective. That
yes.
And in one sentence in your book, that people have color trouble distinguishing standard colors. My wife and I didn't see the same color in the shirt.
Exactly. And that's that was amazing to me, because I really did at that point. Prior to that, I thought that the colors were set,
yeah,
objective.
That there was no disagreement.
Yeah,
if you say the shirt is orange, Angie, your wife, says the shirt is orange.
Yeah. I would like to point out that neither my wife nor I have any form of color blindness, but we see the shirt differently. I see it as blue and she sees it as green.
Well, and there are people that have, and they're different kinds of color blindness.
Exactly.
Daltonism.
Yeah.
And it's interesting for those of us who do see color, like if there's a red flower in a green background, I can see that flower very easily. Or if I drop something, it's not lost to me because I see the difference in the color.
Right.
Somebody who's colorblind has totally lost that red item in that green grass.
Yes. I don't know what it's like to be colorblind, and they don't know what it's like to see color.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can't say in the parking lot, oh, it's next to that red car.
Right.
That's
not helpful. I know. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now, I mentioned that you're a veteran of the U.S. Air Force.
Indeed.
And I know that my friend, who was colorblind, had to have his vision tested when he was going in the Army. And you say, when I joined the Air Force as a young man, we were all given various tests. And one of the tests was the standard test for colorblindness.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the Air Force, that's important because many things and technology are color-coded.
Yes.
And you have to be able to distinguish between red and blue and green.
Mm-hmm.
And if you cannot, there are certain jobs you can't do. You can't be an aircraft mechanic because there's too much color coding.
So this section of your book is very thought-provoking, to say the least. And is there anything else you'd like to say about this third section of your book?
Yeah, well, I would. You went directly to the hardest part of the book. Not everyone is going to identify with an essay on philosophy, and I know that. I was a philosophy major, and people have been kidding me about it ever since. Well, why are you a philosophy major? You're not going to be able to do anything with philosophy, you know?
But that's the very basic of our university educational system. We call somebody with an advanced degree a degree in philosophy, a doctor in philosophy.
Doctor, PhD, doctor of philosophy.
Yeah.
Well, originally it meant a lover of wisdom, directly from the Greek. Oh, incidentally, I'm a priest, right? So I did take a couple of classes in Greek, classical Greek. And philosophy used to mean a lover of wisdom. Natural philosophy used to be what we call now science. So there was that distinguished. Right now, philosophy is like, you know, metaphysics.
Yeah.
Metaphysics, epistemology, and so forth.
And I think most parents, if the kid's going off to college saying, philosophy, you don't want to major in philosophy. You can't earn a living that way.
No, but you can go to law school. You can be a teacher. You can do other things. I became a banker, which was dumb, but I did. I had to make a living, right? And I eventually became an olive farmer. And I worked for the post office because I wasn't making a living as an olive farmer. Olive farming became an adjunct income. And I worked for the post office in Northern California.
Well, and then you were a priest and you...
Yes, I was ordained in retirement, actually, to be a priest for the local church, the lovely little St. Andrew's Church in Corning. And I did that for 6 years, and it was a wonderful part of my life. I was retired by the time I was ordained. And they call it reading for orders, the old man's way to an ordination. And I was an old man at the time, so that suited me just fine.
So I mentioned that your book is in three sections, and I'll remind listeners, you just mentioned you live in Corning.
Yes.
Charles Rouse, and his new book is The Life and Times of Braden Schultz and Other Works. So I mentioned part three. I'm going to go backwards now in your book to the second part, and that's it's completely different from either of the other two parts. But this is the one place where you have a photograph in your book.
Yes.
And what is that a photograph of?
It's a CC.
And in case people didn't understand, it sounds like letters. Assisi is a city in Italy.
Assisi, Italy.
Yeah.
The home place, the home town of St. Francis of Assisi.
So what took you to Italy?
Oh, we've been to Italy. Remember,
meaning you and your wife.
My wife and I. Remember, I told you that the Olive Ranch was an add-on income.
Yeah.
Adjunct income. Well, when it hit, we went to Italy, and usually Italy. And if the olives didn't hit that year, we went to like Reading, you know. But no, we've been to Italy like 13 times, maybe, and we've been to the Holy Land, and we went to a Rhineland cruise. We went to Italy originally for a skiing trip in northern Italy, and we just fell in love with Italy. And we've been back time after time. Assisi is one of our favorite places. We were there twice, and it's just a remarkable little town.
And I think people have heard that related to St. Francis of Assisi.
Yeah.
And you have a photograph of this black and white. And this, you were going to say something about the photograph?
Yes. This was a mistake. It shouldn't have been black and white, and that's since been corrected. If you order a book from Amazon right now, it'll be in color, and it's quite pretty. It's kind of nice, even in black and white, but it's quite remarkable in color. It was a picture that I took on our second trip.
So, and then below it says Assisi, but the title of this section is unexpected. St. Francis and the Wolves?
Indeed. Wolves? You're telling me. You're surprised. I was surprised. It was the patronal festival of St. Francis of Assisi. And we didn't know that when we made the reservations, but it was. And it was busy. And we were down on Saturday. We were downtown having lunch in the plaza. And we looked, there was this dog that was going nuts, you know, this little dog. Was going absolutely crazy. And we looked around, and there was first I thought they were German shepherds, and we looked more closely. There was wolves on leashes. There was four men, and each of them had a wolf on a leash. I couldn't believe it. We just sat there, you know, our jaws were dropping. The wolves were quite placid, and the wolves evidently were used to dogs doing things like that. And incidentally, I don't blame the little dog. The wolves are wild animals, and the little dog knew that perfectly. He knew exactly what he was seeing, and the rest of us had to look more closely.
I would be shocked to see wolves on leashes anywhere.
We were shocked.
Especially
if
you are in Assisi and seeing wolves on leashes.
Yeah. St. Francis had this, you know, it's probably a fable, of course, but it's a charming story of a tame wolf in the village of Gubbio, which is close to Assisi, and he made friends with the wolf, and the wolf stopped eating the villagers' lambs, and the villagers agreed to feed the wolves meat scraps so that he wouldn't go hungry. And that was it's a charming story of St. Francis, and of course Francis was friends with all the animals. And as to whether these guys were a club or not, I don't know, but they were there, and they did have wolves. They were European wolves, yellow eyes. They were wolves.
Yeah, and to this day, wolves are a problem eating farmers' animals that we don't want
them
to eat.
Well, they're a problem in Northern California right now, which is a shame. You know, I would have asked the guys, but they speak Italian and I speak English, and my Italian's not that good. I can order lunch in Italian. That's about it. I can't ask them about their peculiar-looking pets.
Well, if your wife grew up, Spanish was probably your wife's first language.
It is, yeah.
And probably Italian came a little more easily to her than to you.
She actually understands Italian quite well. She watches Italian movies, and she gets along with it quite well. She studied Italian, and it's easy for her because she has the Romance language background. But she still has trouble speaking it. She says when she tries to... I'm telling stories on my wife, aren't I? When she tries to speak Italian, French comes out because she knows French also. My wife, the linguist, right?
Yes. And how long have you two been married?
54 years.
54 years, yeah.
And my Spanish is better than it used to be, but it's still not perfect. My wife is entirely bilingual.
Is there anything else you want to say about St. Francis and the Wolves?
I will say this. If you're able to visit Assisi, Italy, I recommend it. It's a very nice place. It's a charming place. There are wonderful stories. It's great food. The sights are wonderful, and it's just a good place.
And, you know, I've seen here in the States, people have little statues of St. Francis.
Oh, yes.
And why do they want a little statue of St. Francis in their yard or in their garden?
I don't know, but we have one in our garden.
Oh, you do?
Oh, we do, yeah. St. Francis and the birds. And,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They said the birds would land on St. Francis because they knew he was harmless. Isn't that amazing?
And I've seen pictures of people with a pet crow sitting on their shoulder.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so the guest is Charles Rouse. He lives in Corning now. And his book is The Life and Times of Braden Schultz and Other Works. So I'm working backwards now. The third part was for people
right.
interested in philosophy. The second part were people who love Italy,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah.
Now, the first part, how did you come up with an idea of this young 18-year-old?
I have no idea. He just he just popped into my head one day, and with the name and his appearance and the incident that started the story, and I started writing. And four pages later, I knew I had a story, and I kept going. I don't know where Braden came from. He's a gift from the beyond. I have never known anyone like Braden. He's not like me, and I'm not like him.
Well, you do say that you grew up in Glendora.
Yes, I did.
Which is a town not far from Pomona.
Right, and correct.
Why did you mention Pomona when you say that?
I don't know. Braden was from Pomona, and that's all I can say. Of course, I was very familiar with Pomona because Glendora, back in the day, Glendora was a very small town. If you wanted to take the train, which in the 50s, people took trains, not airplanes, okay?
Oh, yeah.
If you wanted to take the train, you had to go to Pomona to take it because they closed down the Glendora station. Pomona had a hospital. We did not. Pomona had a big downtown. Glendora had a small downtown. So and I have people who lived over there, and the family lawyer had his office over there. So I'm kind of familiar with Pomona. I like that town, incidentally.
Well, thank you. And I'm going to remind listeners that the title of your book is The Life and Times of Braden Schultz and Other Works. And I ask him about all three of the sections of his other works. And Charles Rouse lives in Corning now. So thank you for writing this book. It's fascinating. I found it fascinating.
I'm pleased and honored that you say that, Nancy. Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. I'd also like to remind you that my first guest was journalist Don Gagne.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.